This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for Joshua Johnson in Washington. 50 years ago, at this very moment, police in Los Angeles were on the hunt for the perpetrators of two horrific murder scenes. Now, 1 month before, on a night in August in 1969, the followers of an ex-con named Charles Manson brutally killed five people in a house on Cielo Drive, including actress Sharon Tate, who was 8.5 months pregnant, Jay Sebring, Wojciech Frykowski, Abigail Folger, and 18-year-old Stephen Parent died as well that night. The next night, across town, the Manson family killed a grocery store chain owner, Leno LaBianca, and his wife, Rosemary. The country was upended by these murders, the image of flower child hippies morphing into fears of drug-addled, violent counterculture.
In a scene described by one investigator as reminiscent of a weird religious rite, five persons, including actress Sharon Tate, were found dead. Miss Tate was 8 months pregnant and was found with a rope around her neck attached to the body of a man. They were discovered this morning by a maid who ran screaming to neighbors. One officer summed up the murders when he said, "In all my years, I have never seen anything like this before."
That was a newscast from CBS News, 1969, in August, the aftermath of the Cielo Drive murders. 50 years later, Manson and his cult remain a symbol of brutal American violence and the ugly final act of the 1960s. Now, some of you who were alive during those murders shared with us what you remember about those times.
Hi, my name is Maria. Right after the Manson murders, I was in the library in my middle school, and I happened to be looking at Life magazine, and they had photos of the murder scene. I never forgot them. They haunted me for years. I wish I would have never seen those pictures.
My name is Jim. I live in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. My wife and I were born in 65 and 67. One thing we had in common was that as children, we both were terribly frightened by Charles Manson. He was the boogeyman for many of us in our generation.
Hi, this is Kat. I was about the third grade when that event happened, and I remember it dominating the national news. We had a little black and white TV, and it was always Vietnam War footage and Charles Manson's image. Really, that event left such an indelible impression, the Sharon Tate murder. It seemed that Charles Manson's haunting image is just sort of seared into my brain as the epitome of evil.
Thank you to Maria and to Jim and Kat for leaving us those voicemails. You know, Charles Manson became famous after those horrible murders, and many of us, and I count myself in this camp, became fascinated with the Manson murders. It's important to remember in discussions about Charles Manson and in this one that this was an American tragedy, not just a true crime thriller, but a real American tragedy. But here's the question now. What if the infamous story that we all thought we knew about Charles Manson and the family isn't the whole truth? Investigative reporter and author Tom O'Neill spent 20 years filling in the gaps of a narrative that's held up for decades about the Manson family and those murders, including what motivated them. It's all in his new book, Chaos: Charles Manson, the CIA, and the Secret History of the 60s. Tom O'Neill joins me now from WHYY in Philadelphia. Tom O'Neill, what a pleasure.
Hi, thanks for having me, Todd.
And thanks for being here. Tom, first, I gave some details about the Manson murders, what America remembers about them, some of the sketchy details. As we start off here, describe the story of the murders that America came to accept, why they happened. What is it that we believe about these murders?
Well, the official narrative of the story that was presented by the prosecutor Vince Bugliosi at trial, and then later in his best-selling book, Helter Skelter, was that Manson had prophesized a race war that was going to end in the complete termination of the white race with the blacks prevailing. He called it Helter Skelter, based on biblical prophecies and, of course, the Beatles song of the same name. When the race war wasn't happening soon enough, he ordered his followers, who were completely loyal to him by that point, to go out and kill strangers that represented society and represented success that he felt had rejected him his whole life. And they were supposed to leave signs, as he told them, to implicate the Black Panthers. So the first night murders that you described of Sharon Tate and four others, they left "pig" written on blood at the Tate house. The second night at the LaBianca home in Los Feliz, they left "Helter Skelter" written in blood on the refrigerator, "death to pigs," "rise," other words in blood, at the house. Manson had promised his followers that he had located a bottomless pit in the desert in Death Valley where he would protect them during this race war. And he said there were rivers of honey and 12 trees with 12 different kinds of fruits. After the race war ended, after the blacks had prevailed, he would emerge from the hole with his family and subjugate the black race and replenish the earth with his perfect offspring. That's why the murders were committed, according to the official narrative.
Now, let's go back to the time, once again, you mentioned Vincent Bugliosi, the prosecutor who eventually put Charles Manson and the family in jail. Here's Bugliosi talking to the press in July of 1970.
To ignite Helter Skelter, to start the black-white revolution, Manson envisioned that white people would turn against the black man if they thought the black man had committed these seven murders, and ultimately there would be a civil war between blacks and whites out on the street. Manson foresaw that the black man would win this war, but later on he said the black man, because of inexperience, would simply not be able to handle the reins of power, so we would have to look around at those white people who had survived, who had escaped from Helter Skelter. In other words, turn over the reins of power to Charles Manson and his family.
Why the LaBiancas and the persons in the Tate House? Why were they selected by Manson as victims?
Well, you have to realize that if you're going to have a bizarre motive like this, it doesn't really make any difference who the victims are.
Vincent Bugliosi, the prosecutor, talking to reporters. Tom O'Neill, Vincent Bugliosi put the members of the family in prison. He just gave the Helter Skelter narrative, the race war narrative. How did this narrative become cemented in the American consciousness?
Well, for anyone who followed the trial, it got more coverage than any trial in the history of the United States to that point, and probably up until the O.J. trial. They would have learned about it there. But the book, Helter Skelter, that came out in 1974, to this day is the best-selling true crime book of all time. And that really cemented it in the public consciousness. There was a TV movie in 1976 based on the book that went over two nights, and that was at the time the highest rated TV movie of all time. So it became kind of a fixture in popular culture that still more or less exists to this day.
What's the problem with this narrative?
Well, as Bugliosi admitted two or three times in interviews, Manson never believed that motive. Unfortunately, he never admitted this to me when I was interviewing him. When I found out he had said this in earlier interviews, he wasn't speaking to me anymore. He was threatening pretty extensive lawsuits and civil action against me. So I couldn't ask him, if Manson didn't order these murders to ignite a race war, then what was the reason he sent his followers to kill the people that they killed? The motive falls apart kind of with that, and then with the evidence that I uncovered, like you said, over 20 years of getting documents and original reports from different agencies, Sheriff's Office, Los Angeles Police Department, and federal files.
Bailey tweets this, please, please, please stop referring to Charles Manson as a hippie. He was nothing of the kind. The only thing that made him remotely similar to hippies was his long, scraggly hair. He was a psychopath cult leader and nothing more. I think that points, Tom O'Neill, to Charles Manson's place in the violent close of the 60s, the protests against violence in Vietnam and the civil rights movement raging, protests and riots raging in American streets. Charles Manson and his violent family have become entrenched in the American consciousness ever since 1969. What do you think it says about us that we're still talking about Charles Manson today and that Charles Manson became an obsession for you?
I think Vince Bugliosi did a really good job of propagandizing Charles Manson and the family. And your caller is correct. Manson didn't consider himself a hippie. He called them, he and his followers, slippies, because they slipped in and out of people's homes and stole things and did things. He had a real disdain for hippies. He wasn't about peace and love. He was a violent racist. The Life magazine cover that another caller mentioned with that picture of the crime scene was followed 3 months later by this terrifying photo of Manson on the cover of Life, looking for all intents and purposes like Satan. So that kind of became ingrained in the public consciousness. And with that, the 60s and the hippie movement also became attached to Manson's face and Manson's followers. Everybody just kind of combined that all together. And as Bugliosi said, Manson was a metaphor for evil. Hippies were dangerous. The 60s and the free love and drug lifestyle was something that could create something like what happened on August 8th and 9th, 1969.
We're going to talk a lot more about Vincent Bugliosi. He interacts with you at so many points in this story. How much money did he make off of the sale of Helter Skelter?
I never found that out. I don't know. I imagine quite a bit, though.
Still, best-selling, I mean, you've got to be envious, best-selling true crime book of all time, even if there are major holes in the story, which we're going to talk about, right?
Right, right.
I'm speaking with Tom O'Neill. He's author of Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA, and the Secret History of the 60s, and we're going to talk about all of those things in the subtitle. I'm Todd Zwillick. Glad to be with you. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Google. From Connecticut to California, from Mississippi to Minnesota, millions of American businesses are using Google tools to grow online. The Grow with Google initiative supports small businesses by providing free digital skills workshops and one-on-one coaching in all 50 states, helping businesses get online, connect with new customers, and work more productively. Learn more at google.com/grow.
I can't believe that summer is basically over.
I know. And you know what that means. The 2020 presidential race is only going to heat up.
It's a good thing we spent all summer sitting down with the Democratic candidates for president.
Hello.
It is great to be with you.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it.
Check out the NPR Politics podcast feed for exclusive interviews with all the candidates on the debate stage.
Subscribe.
Okay.
Tom, how did you get involved in the crimes of Charles Manson and the family? You were a freelance journalist in L.A. I don't think you've spent your life obsessed with this story. So what was your way in?
I had actually never read Helter Skelter, wasn't interested in the story. I got a call in 1999 from an editor of a magazine called Premiere. I had worked with her at another magazine prior to that, mostly doing entertainment reporting. So this was not up my alley, but it was a very different kind of an assignment. She just wanted me to write what would then have been a 30th anniversary piece about the case, the crimes, how they impacted Hollywood. It was 1999. I told her I wasn't interested, that I'd never read the book and hadn't this been written to death, no pun intended. And she said, you'll find an angle. You need the job. You need the money. I know it. We were actually pretty good friends. And I said, okay. So I thought it'd be 3 months of my life. First thing I did was I got Helter Skelter, read the book, you know, highlighted a couple sections that seemed kind of not fully explained to me, and then had my first meeting with Vince Bugliosi, the prosecutor, who at that point hadn't prosecuted for years. He had left the office after, I think, 1971, 72, had a pretty successful career as an author, had written about 12 books, public speaker. And he very generously welcomed me into his home in Pasadena, and we spent the day together, about 6 hours, discussing the case. And at the end of those 6 hours, I realized that he hadn't told me anything that he hadn't already written in the book or told a million other magazine interviewers. So I did what I call what we call the Hail Mary pass. I asked him if there was anything he could tell me that had never been reported about this before, something new. And he could do it off the record, not for attribution. So he paused, and I could see him contemplating, and then he said, turn it off, referring to my tape recorder. So I turned it off, and he told me something that was pretty explosive and scandalous. And you'll see, or if your listeners get the book, they'll see what it was towards the end of the book when the off-the-record relationship ended and I was able to use it. It kind of sent me down the rabbit hole that lasted for 20 years, that little bit of information led to more and more and more, where in the end it worked against him because I found out that his whole case had been, or major portions of his case had been fabricated. He concealed evidence. He withheld information. He suborned perjury with some of his key witnesses. What's important to know is he had a co-author and a book deal prior to the commencement of the trial in June of 1970. And that author, Kurt Gentry, had a front row seat every day. So he had a conflict of interest. He was playing as much to the future readers of this book as he was to the jury.
But I'm interested in that moment. You started to describe it. Vincent Bugliosi tells you something off the record, but the first piece of paper you turned, the first document you looked at that made you say, wait a second, this doesn't add up. There's a problem here.
It actually was a couple interviews. I got exclusive interviews with some of his key prosecution witnesses. And one of these people was Rudy Altobelli. He owned the house where Sharon Tate was killed. He lived in the back house, but wasn't there that night. He was in Europe with another client. He told me or shared information with me after it took a while to get him to really start talking till he trusted me about Terry Melcher's relationship with Charles Manson. And Terry Melcher was Doris Day's son, a very talented young record producer, talented by his own right. And Terry had testified at the trial that he had met Manson three times, and the last time he auditioned him at the Spahn Ranch as a possible to produce a record for, and wasn't impressed, and very politely advised Manson who else he might work with, and that was that. What I found or heard from Rudy first was that that wasn't the truth, that Manson was much more involved in Melcher and some other of Melcher's friends' lives, and it extended beyond the murder period. I didn't believe it at first, and it took me a year, but once I got into the first important file, really, it was a district attorney's file, Bugliosi's own file at the office, at the DA's office, I found documents corroborating that.
Tom O'Neill, one of the most troubling things that you uncovered in your investigation was this pattern of leniency toward members of the family in the months before the murders in 1969 and maybe even in late 1968. A lot of these members of the family had criminal records. They were on parole or probation. And you document this pattern of arrests and parole violations, probation violations, recommendations to judges for returns to prison. And in case after case and judge after judge, instead of sending these people back to prison, turning them loose, a free pass, not just letting them go, but in some cases, canceling their parole or their probation altogether. What was going on here?
Well, that began with Manson's release from federal prison in March of 1967. He was released in Los Angeles, and he immediately violated his parole by moving up to San Francisco and turning up at the parole office there and announcing that he preferred to live in San Francisco despite being assigned to Los Angeles. Now, normally that person would have been immediately violated and sent right back to prison, especially someone like Manson, who at that time had spent about 12, 15 years in and out of federal prisons. Instead, they assigned him a new parole officer who was doing drug research in the Haight-Ashbury district. And during the following months, Manson got arrested several times, and each time the researcher would look the other way and not violate Manson. Manson should have been sent back at least three or four times the first year, and it was during that year that he became kind of transformed into the messianic cult leader we all knew.
And then the question is why? Why the repeated catch and release? Why the apparent evidence that not only Charles Manson, but members of his family who were felons, who were violating parole and probation, who were giving drugs to minors and were violent, were being caught and released. It seems it's implied heavily in your book that they were being protected.
Yeah, well, one of the kind of important moments in my investigation happened about a year after I had gotten access to Manson's federal parole file. That's where I got the body of the record, the documentary record of Manson's catch and release and the others. And I took that to a retired district attorney of, he had been the DA of Van Nuys, Louis Watnick. And he spread everything out in front of him on his kitchen table in his house and just started shaking his head and saying, this is all chicken expletive. Again and again, I said, what are you saying? He goes, you know, sometimes this can be explained by incompetence, bureaucracy, but this is a deliberate pattern of him being taken in. And instead of being, number one, charged, the charges were dropped. Number two, he should have also been violated. And he wasn't. He said somebody wanted him out. He was more important to somebody outside than he was inside. And I said, well, who could that have been? And he said, I have no idea, but I'd start with looking at federal law enforcement, FBI, and then local law enforcement, Los Angeles PD, sheriffs. And I'm saying, so you're saying he was working for someone? He said he was an informant. And I said, well, how can I ever find out who he was informing for? And he goes, well, that's why they call them informants. You won't, but you should try.
Tom, you have a chapter in your book on the Black Panther Party and other left-wing groups and anti-war groups and the government's programs to actively infiltrate and undermine them. People might remember how the FBI, and this is written about extensively in the press today, how the FBI secretly taped Martin Luther King Jr. and sent those tapes to his wife and urged King to kill himself. That came from the FBI directly. We've seen those documents in the pages of the New York Times and other papers. What was going on with these programs in the late 1960s? And acknowledging, as you do in the book, that this starts to get into the realm of conspiracy, what's the connection to the law enforcement agencies in L.A. that you're talking about?
Well, the COINTELPRO program, which you're talking about, the FBI program that Hoover started originally in the 40s to combat the Ku Klux Klan, then it was discontinued in the 50s and then restarted in the mid-60s when the Panthers had formed. J. Edgar Hoover, Governor Ronald Reagan, and President Lyndon Johnson all believe that the Panthers and the left-wing anti-war movement were the biggest threat to national security. Hoover believed that they were being funded by communists, and he needed to get this program to infiltrate, first to surveil and understand what these groups were doing, the Panthers, the anti-war movement, the free speech people, and eventually to provoke them to commit crimes that they could be arrested for. And then after that, when that wasn't enough, to provoke them to commit acts of murder against one another.
And you found out that this program was operating in L.A. and Southern California at the time.
Oh, yeah, in Los Angeles. And, you know, when all of this stuff came out in congressional hearings in the early 70s, the FBI admitted to the COINTEL operations and took responsibility for, I think, 18 deaths of Panthers or black militants that were the result of them provoking one group against another.
Okay, so Tom, I get it. COINTEL was real. J. Edgar Hoover was undermining the Black Panthers and trying to get leftists to fight each other, was trying to undermine the anti-war movement. Charles Manson and the family maybe were being protected by law enforcement, but then somebody says, no, wait a second. Are you saying that Charles Manson was an FBI asset, that he was important to people like J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI? What exactly, man, are you saying?
Well, as Lou Watnick, that DA, and a few other people told me in law enforcement, informants do all kinds of things. Some of them just share information. Some of them are, as I said earlier, provoked by other informants and agents to become fearful, paranoid, and then attack, which is exactly what Manson did. He believed that the Panthers were going to retaliate for him shooting a black drug dealer who he thought was a Panther about a month before the Tate LaBianca murders, and he was paranoid and fearful of that. I'm presenting a circumstantial case that all these elements were there to better explain why this happened when we find out the real reason why it happened was incorrect, the one that was presented.
What evidence do you have? You said it's a circumstantial case, but it's an incendiary claim. Mm-hmm. Was Charles Manson a law enforcement asset of some kind?
I could never say that definitively, but I have enough people, and you'll see in the book, from law enforcement who worked with assets and informants, including the head of intelligence at the sheriff's office, saying it's a good possibility.
And does that help explain why he may have been protected before the murders, why the family may have been protected before the murders?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Does it help explain why Vincent Bugliosi presented what you say is such a narrow and sensational and false narrative of the motive for the murders?
Exactly, and then worked so hard to keep my book from being published.
Well, maybe he just didn't want competition in the market. I mean, I'm going for the simplest explanation. You understand?
Sure. He didn't want any of this information out there. I brought it all to him. And then he started sending threatening letters to me, to my publisher. It wasn't about competition. There have been tons of Manson books written before mine and after his. And none of them were competition to him. He did not want the truth about what he did at this trial.
Speaking to Tom O'Neill, author of Charles Manson, the CIA and the Secret History of the 60s, it's called Chaos. We'll be back in a moment with your comments, your questions, and more on Tom O'Neill's 20-year investigation of the Manson murders. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is 1A. I'm just a soul. Understood.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Uber. Uber is committed to safety and to continuously raising the bar to help make for safer journeys for everyone. All driver partners go through a multi-step safety screen before their first trip, including driving and criminal history checks. And Uber is introducing a brand new safety technology called RideCheck, which can detect if a trip goes unusually off course and check in to provide support. To learn more about Uber's commitment to safety, visit uber.com/safety.
When you think of country music, you probably have a particular image in mind. But as you can imagine, the history is way more complicated.
This week on Throughline, we sit down with filmmaker Ken Burns to talk about his new documentary about the origins of country music.
Throughline from NPR, the podcast where we go back in time
to understand the present.
Let's address the problem of conspiracies. Mm-hmm. How do you respond when someone says, you know, mind-blowing conspiracies, they're fun, they're great, they sell books, but that's all they are. Usually the simplest explanation is the right one. And here, prosecutors laid out a simple case that convicted Charles Manson and members of the family, and that's good enough. It's as simple as that.
Well, I think the problem with that is we need to know who was really involved and how and why these things happened, especially something that was so kind of culturally significant as this. You know, it was a real turning point in American history. The 60s kind of culminated in this case and represent what people think went wrong with the whole 60s free love and drug ethos. I believe there were other people involved in these murders and there were provocations, and I worked really hard not to present anything that I couldn't document in the book because I have an aversion to being called a conspiracy theorist, who probably everyone does. And instead of finding a complete narrative, I just present information that's provable, documented. I've got 60 pages of endnotes to show where the official story is inaccurate and invented. And, you know, another important moment came when I took some of these documents to the original defense attorneys for Manson and the women, and they were outraged. They said that this stuff had been withheld from them. They would have done an entirely different defense, and the prosecution was required by Brady law to share anything exculpatory, meaning anything that could impeach one of their own prosecution witnesses for not telling the truth on the stand.
And I want to point out, I mean, you uncovered some serious misconduct by Vincent Bugliosi and his team, not only in the courtroom prosecutorial misconduct, as you mentioned, but also private misconduct. He really became an enemy of yours, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, he didn't want any of that other information out that involved prior episodes of his own criminal conduct, even before he got assigned this case and then after. And some of it is pretty salacious, but the only reason I used it was because it also involved court cases. You know, when he was sued for some of the crimes he committed by the victims, he perjured himself. He admitted it later. He lied to police. He lied to the media. He was running for office. So, you know, you have to present kind of a pattern of conduct to support your allegation for the main body of my work, which is, you know, this trial and his conduct in that.
You found out something rather incendiary that I never knew, and it's very well documented in the book. Evidence that Vincent Bugliosi, the prosecutor, not the defense attorney, but the prosecutor, handpicked the public defender who defended Susan Atkins when she was in grand jury testimony, that he essentially manipulated her testimony before the trial even got started.
Before she was even identified publicly as a suspect in the Tate-LaBianca murders, the prosecution learned that she was telling two cellmates at the jailhouse. She was being held on another murder charge, Gary Himmon, who I mentioned earlier, that she and her group were responsible for Tate-LaBianca. She had a court-appointed attorney at that point who was representing her in that case. And when they realized that she could be a pivotal prosecution witness for them, but she was likely not to cooperate, they went to a judge in Santa Monica, and I've got all the notes of these hearings that nobody had ever seen before, these meetings at the prosecution's office in Los Angeles, and had the judge remove her legally court-appointed attorney and change him, switch onto her case a former prosecutor named Richard Caballero, who did exactly what the prosecution needed him to do and got her to cooperate. From that moment on, and that was prior to her or Manson or anybody being identified in the media as suspects in this case, we shouldn't trust anything that happened after that, because from that point on, the well was poisoned. You know, they planted a prosecutor on the defense, and everything from then there in that occurred was scripted by the prosecution office. It's difficult, you know, in a short amount of time to provide all the evidence I have, but I think it is important to emphasize what Bugliosi's co-prosecutor, Stephen Kay, said to me in an interview on tape on the record when I presented him with all this evidence. And he knew the case actually better than Bugliosi by that point, because he stayed in the DA's office for 30 years. He helped Bugliosi prosecute the original trial and three subsequent ones. And then when I was interviewing him in 2005, he was about to retire, and he had appeared at 60 parole hearings for Manson family members over 30 years, arguing against their parole. And at each of those hearings, he had to present a minute, detailed account of their crimes, how and why they happened. He said, "You'll never get me to believe any of this happened differently, no matter what you show me." Then I showed him the documents I have, and it's in the book. He basically sunk into like a pile of nothingness in his chair, shaking his head, saying, "I can't believe what I'm seeing here. I don't know what to think. This is Vince's handwriting. This stuff was never shared with me or with anybody else." He goes, "But it's clearly what a different scenario." And he goes, "If he did this, if he lied about these things I was showing him, then what else did he lie about? I don't know what to believe about this case anymore."
Now, you don't posit in this book that Manson and the family didn't commit the murders. But
no.
But you do posit that there was enough misconduct, enough unreported police activity, enough protection that the verdict, if it was known to defense attorneys, could have been overturned.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what actually Stephen Kay said to me that day in 2005, in February, when I said to him, I go, "Well, what do I do with this information now?" And I could tell he didn't want to say it, but he said, "Well, you might want to take it to the DA, the current DA, who was Stephen Cooley." And I said, "What might he do?" And he said he might call for a new trial, overturn the verdicts and call for a new trial.
Tom, the subtitle of your book is Charles Manson, The CIA and the Secret History of the 60s. The CIA is right there in the subtitle in bold relief, and we have to talk about it.
Sure.
A lot of people have wondered over the decades how an ex-con, basically illiterate like Charles Manson, learned to so adeptly control people with manipulation and with LSD. He was a real true expert in taking over people's minds and their motivations with a combination of affection, rejection, and drugs. How did he learn how to do this? What's the circumstantial evidence that you believe that explains how Charles Manson learned how to do this?
Well, now we really go down the conspiracy.
We sure do, and it's a strange place to go, but it's in the title of your book. And you write about in your book how you go down this rabbit hole of conspiracy to places where even you don't want to go.
Yeah, I worked really hard to try to stay away, and then I kept going back and going back because it was too compelling to ignore. In Helter Skelter, in the epilogue, Bugliosi wrote, "The one mystery that remains is how Manson learned how to control these young people's minds so much to the extent that they would go out and kill, on command, complete strangers with no remorse afterwards." That was something that I was kind of haunted by. And as I got deeper and deeper into documents, I discovered that when Manson was released and went to San Francisco in the spring of 67 and was assigned to this parole officer who was doing drug research in the Haight at the same time, he started frequenting the newly opened Haight-Ashbury Free Medical Clinic, which opened in June of 67. And Manson's parole officer was conducting research out of there along with another psychiatric, well-known guy named Dr. Louis Jolyon West, who was recruiting hippies to study the effects of LSD on them out of this clinic. And what came out in the mid-70s was, after congressional investigations sparked by Seymour Hersh's reporting in the New York Times, was that the CIA had a secret program 20 years old called Operation MKUltra, where they were trying to learn how to create Manchurian candidates, people who would assassinate, kill other people on command.
Okay, so Louis Jolyon West was, you establish in the book, was a CIA researcher in using LSD for mind control.
And hypnosis.
And hypnosis. And you also establish that Charles Manson spent some significant time in very close proximity to this man at a clinic in San Francisco.
And during the period that they were both there, the 3 or 4 months from about June to September, October of 67, Manson emerged with this group of women, mostly young women, couple men, who had become exactly what the MK Ultra program was trying to create, program killers who would kill without question.
Well, the book is full of circumstantial evidence, conspiracy theories, plenty of evidence, I want to say. It's a very compelling read. This story took over your life for 20 years. You got a book out of it. Just briefly, are you happy you did it?
Oh, boy, that's a big question. Sometimes I still wish I had never said yes to the assignment. Other times it was, you know, some of the most exciting times of my life was chasing these leads down and getting these documents. So I guess today I'll say, yeah, I'm glad I did it, especially when I do an interview like this with you, Todd.
You have to read it for yourself. The book is Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA, and the Secret History of the 60s. Tom O'Neill, thank you so much.
Thank you, Todd. I appreciate it.
Today's conversation was produced by Haley Blassingame and edited by Orion Donovan-Smith. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Todd Zwillick. Thanks so much for listening. This is 1A.